This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online later at aspenpublicradio.org. Today we'll be talking with pianist Conrad Tau, who performs in three Aspen Music Festival concerts this week. Then we'll chat with mezzo-soprano Alexander Urquiola, one of the stars of the Cole Porter Review, Let's Misbehave, coming up this Wednesday evening at Harris Hall. And finally, we'll talk with members of the Skyros String Quartet, who surprised me by walking into the recording studio with a CD of theirs that had just been released less than an hour ago. Pianist Conrad Tau has performed all five Beethoven piano concerti in a single weekend, taken on other monumental performing tasks in the last few years. He's also an avid composer who has studied with Christopher Theophanides and others. This week, he offers a solo recital August 18th, a chamber recital August 20th, and a performance of the piano part of Beethoven's Choral Fantasy August 21st. I caught up with him when he came here last winter for an Aspen Public Radio-sponsored recital. Conrad, the first thing I'm interested in is how you build a repertoire when you're putting together a concert, and what kind of journey are you taking your audience on?
How do I put repertoire together on a concert? It's one of the great pleasures of being a performer. It's one of the most exciting parts of the job, actually, is it putting a program together. It's like putting together a mixtape, curating something, and really trying to make an experience, trying to chart a journey, I guess. A lot of the times I work quite instinctively, almost, I guess, sensuously. I like my programs to feel like they have a kind of sensuous logic about them. And yet, at the same time, sometimes there are thematic things that either come up after the fact, after sort of an initial pass at a program, and then there are sometimes thematic concerns that are present from the beginning. So it's an interesting mixture of both of those things. I love juxtaposing pieces that maybe are not usually placed alongside one another. I think juxtaposition is more interesting to me than, say, I guess, fusion. I like friction more than fusion. I find friction potentially really galvanizing and exciting. I like to see what sparks come out of rubbing two pieces against each other. I like to think that if you juxtapose two pieces in a certain way, you can glean more possibilities, interpretive, emotional, what have you, possibilities that maybe were not so immediately self-evident, you know, something that you can find because of this recontextualization. So that's usually the motivating factor.
One of the things when you bring friction into a program is, of course, that you're creating a challenge for the audience. And I'd like to ask about that, too. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I don't want to create a total dichotomy between comfort and challenge. But still, there is a sort of a spectrum there.
Absolutely.
And you seem to fall on the somewhat challenging side without being off the cliff,
right.
Challenging. In other words, you take audiences for a ride and you hope they can follow along to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I think I should disclaim that I am kind of predisposed to enjoy challenges when I'm an audience member. I mean, for me, it's an exciting thing. For me, it's a journey. And for me, it's when I'm a little bit confused by something initially, or when something seems a little bit inscrutable, maybe my first thought is actually, why might that be? And then how can I maybe find a way in? And on some level, it's exciting because it means that there isn't quite as obvious a way in. And then I can maybe burrow one myself.
Right.
There's something really lovely about that to me. And so I don't know. I hope, however, that the sort of sensuous approach that I try to take with my program shaping and then also hopefully my performance, that it is something I aim for. I hope that there's an urgency to that people can sense. I try to maintain a spirit of generosity when I'm putting these things together, when I'm performing a program that maybe will have a lot of works that are a little bit unfamiliar to some audience members. On stage, it's a gesture of, I love this. I am so lucky to be able to share this with you. And I would love to share it with you. And I would love to have you follow me, but also kind of go off on your own tangents. I mean, I love the idea of taking my audiences for a ride. I really want to get an active response from an audience more than anything. I think when sometimes people will come up to me after a concert and say that they didn't like something, like specifically, like they'll come up and ask, what do you think about this? And And sometimes the ensuing conversation can be amazing because the ensuing conversation will result in an audience member making some sort of breakthrough on their own that I had never thought of. And that's just a wonderful exchange, I think. And I hope that me taking audience members on a bit of a ride is kind of the first step to having that exchange.
It seems like you often pick pieces that have a lot of physicality to them.
That's true.
One aspect of your playing is the sheer physicality. You're not a big hulking man, but you are. But you wouldn't know it from hearing you play sometimes. Is that part of the enjoyment too? It's just waking people up with just the sheer power of the piano.
I think so. I mean, I'm certainly really attracted to that. I do love my extremes. I have to fess sure. up to that. I do love it. I love the physical effect that listening to music can have. I mean, that's something I'm after a lot of the time. And I think it's worth mentioning, however, that there's a certain physical effect that delicate, incredibly soft playing also yields,
sure.
which is another thing I do try to remember and strive for, you know, the sort of prickly goosebump sensation that you can get at the best moments. Probably my favorite piano concerto of all time, if I had to pick one, would be the Ravel G major.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the second movement, of course, is really kind of that
yes.
piece. It's that, I have very sentimental memories associated with Aspen when it comes to that piece of kind of playing the second movement on the Castle Creek campus, the old one, mm-hmm. the old, like more, the less beautiful one, the one that I have a lot of nostalgia for, and just kind of playing it in a practice room and being surrounded just by the sound of Castle Creek and sound of insects and, you know, being kind of maybe one of two or three people in the practice area at night, you know, at like 8:30 or 9 in the evening, skipping a concert and instead doing this. And just that kind of magic is something I really want to remember and capture sometimes. But I love physicality. I think what I like about it is that it's present and temporal and spontaneous. And those are all things that I associate with performance in general. Those are all unique and I think potentially really galvanizing qualities or properties of performance.
Do you have a growing sense of yourself as an artist and what kind of role you play in the larger society possibly, or what you may have to contribute besides just saying, okay, I'm going to play some music and everybody will applaud and be happy and go home? Is there anything else beyond that that perhaps you imagine that you might be able to bring not only to the concerts, but what your life represents and, mm-hmm. and your place in the world?
My ambitions generally are actually kind of abstract. My goals are quite abstract to the point of them being almost unreachable, I think, mm-hmm. Which I think is actually, for me, usually when I'm feeling positive and very optimistic, that's a exciting thing. It's exciting to have goals that you feel like you can constantly push towards. And I have, I think, perhaps a slightly naive hope that, you know, even the way I approach performance, for example, the way that I think of performance as insistently present and physical and temporal and bodily, for me, it's a way of maybe questioning or throwing a wrench, hopefully, in the easy masterpiece narrative where, you know, performers are just vessels for these magical ideas that come to composers working alone by candlelight or something, you know, that whole mystique. I find mystique rather boring. Mm-hmm. I find it also a little bit potentially harmful because I think that it, more than anything, mystique kind of serves to distance artists from audiences, not in the sense of, you know, I need my privacy, but simply in the larger cultural sense of like, oh, I guess what it is it further reinforces the idea that what we're doing is completely out of reach. And I there's something about that absolutely rubs me the wrong way. It also doesn't really mm-hmm. resonate with how I feel and how I grew up. It's not the way I learned to understand or think about music. I'd like to think that performing a certain way, and also, of course, making those intentions explicit, I'd like to think that maybe it allows us to go back to the performance as a creative site, as a spontaneous site, and that's a kind of a naive hope, I think, that that'll have any real impact on the larger masterpiece narrative that oftentimes we're beholden to. But that is something I would love to do, because I do think that that would have other ramifications. I think if we were to move a little bit away from that understanding of culture, we've already started seeing this in literary circles. You know, there the notion of a canon is being increasingly questioned. And I think if we were to really kind of move in that direction more, we would see much more interesting ramifications, because I think that it would also, purely selfishly, as a listener and a performer, I think it would yield more surprising analyses. I think it would yield more surprising performances. Mm-hmm. And I just imagine in my head a world in which conservatory students don't take the greatness of Beethoven for granted. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's like, let's look at this score, let's think about it, let's consider it. And I just imagine the different possibilities that that could yield.
Tell us a little bit about your new recording.
So my new recording is centered around Pictures at an Exhibition. It was a live recording of Pictures at an Exhibition that I did in a studio in Boston. It's a weird score. It fell out of favor with pianists after the Ravel orchestration kind of took mm-hmm. over and became a huge success. I think it was a Richter recording of Pictures that suddenly made every pianist at every conservatory in the world suddenly pick the piece up again. It's a weird piece. The piano score looks awkward. Like, there's something about the way the notes look on the page that seems odd. It seems almost strikingly contemporary to me. Mm-hmm. And so I love embracing that piece's oddity. You know, I love the weirdness of its time signatures and the promenade. I love the weird voicings. And I also, of course, love the tradition of reorchestrating pictures that exist. Not only the Ravel orchestration, but there are plenty of other sure. orchestrations. But then you have stuff like Isao Tomita's electronic realization with the Moog synthesizer, I believe, which, if you think about it, is painstaking work, because this is the 70s we're talking about, and this is painstakingly like one layer of sound at a time. I love that recording. It's legitimately one of my favorite renditions of the work. What I love about it is, what choices does he make? How does he hear voices? Because Mazursky is a little bit ambiguous about where voices are even within the score. Mm-hmm. And then there's stuff like the Emerson, Lake, and Palmer version, and I'm not a rock person. I'm not a prog rock person at all, so it's a little less to my taste, but I think it's amazing that it exists, and I think that there's something really special about the score that calls people to it in that way. So I'm excited about that being out, and I'm excited about people being able to hear my love for the piece. I really do love that work a lot. And then it's surrounded by pieces that also are imagistic. Takemitsu's Les Yeux Clos d'Eux, which takes its title from a painting, in fact. And then also a piece by David Lang called Cage, which is not only in its own right very coloristic and imagistic, but also relates to the pictures as a memory piece. Cage is the first of David Lang's memory pieces for piano, a set of piano pieces, each of which is dedicated to a friend that David Lang lost. And of course, as we know, Mazursky's Pictures at an Exhibition is its own set of memory pieces in memory of Victor Hartmann. The Lang is written in memory of John Cage. So it's kind of just this set of pieces that I think talk to each other in ways that I find very evocative.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been talking with pianist Conrad Tau, who offers a solo recital August 18th, a chamber music recital August 20th, and a performance of the piano part of Beethoven's Choral Fantasy on August 21st. Now let's talk with mezzo-soprano Alexandra Urquiola about her role in the upcoming Cole Porter song and dance show, Let's Misbehave, on August 19th. Well, Alexander, here you are at the Aspen Music Festival and School, and you've been studying classical opera all summer.
I have, yeah.
I guess you really get to let your hair down with Cole Porter this week, don't you?
I absolutely do. It's a wonderful opportunity to get to sing this music and to really explore a completely different art form from classical music.
It seems to me as though young voices are, I would think that in some ways they would be particularly well suited for Cole Porter, because you can bounce over the lyrics really fast, and mm-hmm. I mean, there's a certain kind of quality that a younger voice has.
Absolutely.
Do you feel that you and your colleagues are catching the spirit of this amazingly urbane, witty composer?
It's funny that you mention that, because I just had a lesson with my teacher this past week, and I brought in my Cole Porter, and I thought, oh gosh, he's going to rip me to shreds. Mm-hmm. This is going to be terrible, because it's music that's just so different from what we usually work on.
Right.
And after I was done singing, he said, that is the most natural I've ever heard you sound. He said, you should warm up on the Cole Porter songbook. And I was thinking about it, and we realized after a while that the reason for that is that it's so conversational. you have to use your natural voice. It's basically like speaking and just inflecting it with tone and support of your breath and really infusing everything that you learned with the classical style and that training into just how you would normally speak. And Cole Porter is such a master at that because, as you know, he wrote his own lyrics. So you write the music and the words, you are writing the music for the words, and it just has a magical quality to it that a lot of composers can't necessarily give you.
And what lyrics those are. And I wonder about that too, as a young artist, and again, not just you personally, but, but all of your colleagues. I wonder if you have a sense of the world that he lived in a sense, the meaning of a lot of those words, because some of them are pretty subtle.
Subtle. It's funny. I never realized.
I'm using a euphemism.
Yes, absolutely. I caught it. It's so funny because I never realized just how raucous this music is and how wild some of the lyrics are.
It is so sexy.
It is very innuendo driven. And we've had a very, very interesting time working it out. And I remember the first rehearsal that we all sat down and looked at this music. We were all just sort of in awe that stuff like that wasn't restricted, that people were able to let loose in such a way. We see music today and we say, oh, where is society heading? But I don't know, you listen to something like Let's Misbehave and everything goes crazy.
And anything goes, right?
Yeah, anything goes.
So it's a whole songbook of Cole Porter tunes. I mean, it's just one after another after another. My understanding is that some of the Cole Porter songs that are very popular today came from real bombs on the Broadway stage, but then he would pull out some of the great songs.
Yes.
Either reuse them or just put them out as a, you know, as a 78 RPM single or whatever.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about a few of the songs that maybe stand out for you or certainly the ones that you'll be singing?
I will be singing my two solo numbers in this art, Let's Misbehave and I've Got You Under My Skin. And I've Got You Under My Skin, I believe, is from not well-known Cole Porter show. But the song is timeless. I mean, the amount of times and the amount of different recordings that I've heard of that music, it kind of surpassed the show and whatever the show's meaning was. I know one of my friends, Jake, is singing After You Who, which I believe is from a show called The Gay Divorce, which I've never heard of before in my entire life. But the song is just so beautiful and it's so sincere that it would have been a shame if it didn't go beyond the musical that unfortunately failed.
You have sung a lot of Jake Hagee along the way, haven't you?
I have,
Am I right?
Yeah, you're very right. And, wow.
And Jake Hagee's obviously in many ways more serious. He's not that kind of witty composer, but he also is somebody who I think really knows how to use the human voice to just inflect it in a very natural way. Is that part of your appeal for singing his music?
100%. This past year, I had the opportunity to perform with my undergrad, Northwestern University, Dead Man Walking. That was our winter opera. And the music is just so beautiful. And there's just such depth and a truth and sincerity to the text which he uses. It's so tempting to just completely delve into it because the themes that he decides to use are very, very sincere. I also, for my recital this past year, I did a set called Before the Storm, which is not very well known. It's not performed very often because some of the tunes are a little on the modern side, but he has a third song on it in the third movement is absolutely stunning. And like Cole Porter, it's taken out of context a lot and used in its own right as a song separate from the cycle. But the whole story of the cycle is just precious. It's all about love as seen through a storm. And that metaphor, really delving into it, was a challenge that I loved to accept for my recital. And I ended up, after really studying the cycle, basing my whole recital off it.
Kind of going back to the Cole Porter thing, and I would say that the Jake Hagee reminded me of a similar sort of challenge, but what do you think the disadvantages are or the challenges are? What do you have to overcome as a classically trained singer to make Cole Porter really shine? Are there restraints on you as a classical singer that you have to break through in order to make Cole Porter work?
Yeah, definitely. Cole Porter, I would say, uses a part of your voice that, although it all comes from the core of having a good breath support and having a well-built technique system to be able to sing any of it honestly and in a healthy way, opera just comes with it. There's a greater depth to it. And if I approached, I don't know, Let's Misbehave the way that I approached Cherubino, I would be at a loss for words. It's just a completely different character, and you have to infuse it with the society that you're given as well. Mm-hmm. I can't infuse the sound of Mozart and try and stay true to that artist and the era in which he lived and was inspired by the same way that I think of like 1920s, 1930s Cole Porter.
Whenever I hear a Cole Porter song on the radio or something, I imagine dancing too. Do you have to be a triple threat to pull this off? Are you yourself going to be doing some dancing? Or are they going to bring in some dancing for this show?
My dancing is very limited in the show.
Are you glad for that?
I am very glad for that. I'm very thankful. Although we do get a wonderful education here. There is a wonderful movement class that we are all required to take in the Aspen Opera Theater Center with a wonderful choreographer who's the dance teacher at Juilliard named Jean Slater. Mm-hmm. She's really helped me understand like how to move and how to move on a stage, and that's definitely going to be featured in the Cole Porter. But there are some wonderful dancers, Eric Olson and Zoe Johnson in particular, who have had a lot of dance experience and are going to do Fred and Ginger-esque number, which is going to be very cute. I hope it's going to be a crowd pleaser. It's definitely a highlight of the show for me.
Is it kind of a fun break for you to say? I mean, Cole Porter, it must be just like having cool water splashed on your face after the heat of opera.
Absolutely. So.
Well, we look forward to hearing you and your colleagues just let her rip up there.
Yeah.
No restraints, okay?
We'll try.
Okay. Thank you so much,
Thank
Alexander.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Mezzo-soprano Alexandra Urkiola talking about her role in the upcoming Cole Porter review, Let's Misbehave.
I get no kick in a plane, flying too high with some gal in the sky is my idea of nothing to do. Yet I get a kick out of.
Finally, a few words with the Skyros String Quartet as they transition from a student ensemble to career musicians next week.
Well, this began with a grant through our university, the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. And we had a grant through the school, which initially began the funding. And from there, we did a Kickstarter. And we actually got a lot of support from our friends, family, and community through the Kickstarter campaign.
As well as people we don't know, which is really fantastic.
That's really great when that starts happening. It's like, who is this guy in New Zealand who thinks we're cool?
Australia.
Oh, almost.
Yeah. The Netherlands, Germany, it was really great. Ireland.
That is fantastic. So tell us a little bit about the CD. I see one piece by Benjamin Britten, one by Torina, who I never even know wrote for string quartet, and then we have a Sibelius quartet. Would one of you want to say a few things about the different pieces here?
Yeah, I'll pipe in here for that. A couple years ago, actually, we attended a Deer Valley Music Festival in Park City, Utah. And we had been working on the Sibelius Quartet, I think, at that time, and the Britten Divertimenti as well. We were working with one of the members of the quartet. We were talking to him about starting a CD, and he suggested these pieces would be our strength, and they were. And we also were really interested in trying new like works that aren't really heard that often.
These are really great pieces by composers who, all of whom really had, a great sense of melody. Congratulations, and just so everybody knows, it's called Skyros Quartet Introspective Odyssey. So you're at the end of your time at the Aspen Music Festival in school. Where are you all going together from here? Are you about to take that step from student to career quartet?
We are. So after this, we're driving back to Nebraska for a couple days, picking up all of our things, and then moving to Seattle. And we're not really sure exactly what we're going to do there yet. We have a lot of ideas. We don't have a job. We're just going to go and be a quartet and freelance and make money and change the world. But we just feel Seattle's a great community, a great opportunity with lots of support for the arts. And there isn't a full-time quartet living there right now that we know of.
Well, there will be in a couple weeks.
Yes.
I also wonder what you argue about, because one string quartet told me that they argue about what kind of major third to play, whether it's the major third that you would hear on the piano or the natural major third, which is a little bit flatter than that. Do you argue about that, or do you argue about other things before coming to a resolution?
We've heard horror stories, not horror stories, but we hear of
there are
groups.
Horror stories.
Yes, of quartets arguing, and you know, we try everything. And that kind of cuts down on a lot of arguments that would come up. Like, so if we was like, we'll try a piano major third, we'll try a pure intonation major third. You know, so, you know, we just try them both. And then sometimes we just send someone out and say, well, that sounds better, and we trust that one person. but that, you know, you can't get away from arguments. They, in our quartet, they usually are personal arguments, like someone's pissing someone else off, and then it becomes quiet, and then, you know, two people have to hash out the personal issues, and I would say that the arguments we have are more personal than musical, actually, because we try, you know, as many musical ideas, but, you know, there's always the four different people. But I think that's really great because, you know, if you had four people that were the same personality, it'd be kind of boring.
our mentor, John Largesse from Mural Quartet, often called it malleable conviction, mm-hmm. where you need to have your own convictions and you have to be really strong about them, but at the same time, be willing to bend and change them.
Do any of you have strong interests in other realms that have nothing to do with music, whether it be a hobby or politics, or one of you goes and meditates like 5 hours a day or something like that?
I think we all definitely have really strong interests. Myself, it's Lego. I love Lego ever since I was a kid, and you know, it's such an imaginative toy, and I actually would say that Lego has really helped me become a very imaginative person, because, you know, you just get a bunch of blocks and you have to make something of it,
making the world a better place one block at a time.
Sure. So I think it's a great, not only toy, but it's a tool to train the mind and imagination. And then also, I'm from Canada, Northern Ontario, so I've loved hockey for pretty much my whole life as well. Wasn't allowed to play it because I have injuries. My parents were like, you know, you want to be a musician, you're not playing hockey.
Okay. Yeah. And anybody else with any strong interest or anything?
I've been really enjoying hiking here in the mountains, and I'm really excited to be in Seattle, in Washington, where there's so much great hiking.
I knit. That's one thing that I love to do. I'm interested in other visual arts. Right now, I've been dyeing scarves, which is really fun for me, and creating patterns on scarves. I'm also, yes, as you say, vegan, and I actually have a very strong interest in that community, and I have an Instagram page that's got maybe close to 4,000 followers, where I post some of my creations.
Some of your culinary creations.
Yeah, yes. So now that I'm done with schooling, I can hopefully start some kind of website, actually probably for people in the arts, because I'm also very interested in nutritional science, and I have a lot of ideas about how I could help people with inflammatory issues.
I wonder if you could help traveling musicians, because in all seriousness, sometimes it's a real challenge to eat well, even if you're not a vegan, if you're just trying to eat healthy.
Yes.
That can be a challenge on the road.
And I do have tips for that. I often go into restaurants and I ask for something special. And actually, chefs are very accommodating. Mm-hmm. And there are ways to talk to them about this. So it's something that can be done.
Trigger their creativity instead of making demands. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any extra?
Yeah. Just like Justin, I'm also big time into hockey. I didn't play. I played soccer growing up because my dad's British. So I didn't really learn how to skate. I taught myself to skate in my late 20s. And we both have rec center passes, Justin and I. So we go skating almost every day.
It's a nice sheet of ice.
Well, it's interesting to see such a contrasting world of interests that the four of you have. I hope you continue to pursue those as you pursue your career together. And congratulations on the CD, and thank you for coming to the station.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Information about the Skyros Quartet's new CD and their upcoming performances are all online at skyrosquartet.com. That's SKYROS Quartet.com. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 or the rebroadcast Saturdays at 3 for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.